give anyone performance appraisals or promotions or raises, but they do decide on the vision of the car and how the car will be made, by persuasion, not coercion. It's this idea that I wanted to embody within Scrum. John Shook of the Lean Enterprise Institute once began his description of the chief engineer role by quoting the U.S. Marine Corps Leadership Manual. An individual's responsibility for leadership is not dependent on authority. The deep-rooted assumption that authority should equal responsibility is the root of much organizational evil. I believe misunderstanding around this issue is rampant, problematic, and runs so deep in our consciousness that we don't even realize it. Reflecting on my time at West Point and in Vietnam, I found myself agreeing that leadership has nothing to do with authority. Rather, it has to do with, among other things, knowledge and being a servant leader. The chief engineer can't simply say something has to be done a particular way. He has to persuade, cajole, and demonstrate that his way is the right way, the best way. It usually takes someone with 30 years of experience to fill the role. I wanted that in Scrum, but I'm also well aware that very few people have that level of skill and experience. So I split the role in two, giving the Scrum Master the how and the product owner the what. Even in those early days of Scrum, I knew that I needed someone who was deeply connected to the customer. The product owner needed to be able to deliver feedback to the team from the customer each and every sprint. They needed to spend half their time talking to the people buying the product, getting their thoughts on the latest incremental release and how it delivered value, and half their time with the team creating the backlog, showing them what the customers valued and what they didn't. Remember, the customer could be the general consumer, a big bank, your husband, or someone who needs the rotavirus vaccine and is depending on you to get it to them. The customer is anyone who will get value from what you're doing. But I didn't want a manager. I wanted someone the team would believe and trust when he prioritized the backlog. So I went and got the smartest guy in product marketing. Not in engineering, mind you, but marketing. And that's how Don Rodner became the first product owner. He knew the product we were making not from a technical point of view, although he understood enough of that to communicate with the engineers, but rather from a customer point of view. What did the people who were actually using the product need? When you're picking a product owner, get someone who can put themselves in the mind of whoever is getting value from what you're doing. As a friend of mine says, "My wife is the perfect product owner. She knows exactly what she wants. I just implement it." Not only does the product owner need a wider range of skills than a Scrum Master, they need to be held to a different set of standards. The Scrum Master and the team are responsible for how fast they're going and how much faster they can get. The product owner is accountable for translating the team's productivity into value. Over the years, I boiled down the essential characteristics of a product owner to four. One, the product owner needs to be knowledgeable about the domain. By this, I mean two things. The product owner should understand the process the team is executing well enough to know what can be done and, just as important, what can't. But the product owner also has to understand the what well enough to know how to translate what can be done into true, meaningful value. It could be a computer system that helps the FBI catch terrorists, or a teaching method that improves student performance in public schools. The product owner needs to know the market well enough to know what will make a difference. Two, the product owner has to be empowered to make decisions. Just as management shouldn't interfere with the team, the product owner should be given the leeway to make decisions about what the product vision will be and what needs to be done to get there. This is important because the product owner is under pressure from a lot of different stakeholders, both internal and external, and has to be able to hold firm. The product owner should be responsible for outcomes, but let the team make their own decisions. Three, the product owner has to be available to the team to explain what needs to be done and why. While the product owner is ultimately accountable for the backlog, there needs to be a constant dialogue with the team. Often the team's expertise will inform the decisions the product owner needs to make. The product owner has to be reliable, consistent, and available. Without access to him, the team won't know what to do or what order to do it in. They rely on the product owner for the vision and also market intelligence on what is important. If the product owner isn't available to the team, the whole process can fall apart. This is one of the reasons I rarely recommend that CEOs or other senior executives be product owners. They just don't have the time the team needs. 4. The product owner needs to be accountable for value. In a business context, what matters is revenue. I measure a product owner by how much revenue they deliver per point of effort. If the team is producing 40 points of work every week, I want to measure how much revenue is created for each and every point. But the measurement of value could be how many successes a team has. I know one law enforcement team that measured value by the number of arrests of wanted felons they made each week. I know churches that use Scrum and measure their success by how well they're serving their congregation and whether it's growing. The key is to decide what the measure of value is and hold the product owner accountable for delivering more of it. In Scrum, this kind of metric is easy to observe because of the method's incredible transparency. Now, that's a lot to ask of one person, and it's the reason why in big projects, there's usually a team of product owners to address all the needs. I'll get into the details of that later. But first, as a way of visualizing what the product owner needs to do, I want you to imagine you're in the cockpit of an F-86 Sabre with the Mad Major, John Boyd, about to enter a dogfight over the Korean Peninsula. Observe, orient, decide, act. Air-to-air combat during the Korean War took place mainly between American F-86 Sabres and Russian-made MiG-15s. The MiG was faster, more maneuverable, had a greater thrust-to-weight ratio, and was all around a superior aircraft. On paper, MiG-15s should have wiped the skies of American pilots. Instead, they were shot down by a 10-to-1 ratio. The struggle to figure out how that could possibly happen shaped the future of warfare. It also became critical in the development of Scrum. John Boyd was simply the greatest fighter pilot who ever lived, although he never shot down an enemy in combat. He only flew 22 missions over Korea before the armistice, and back then you had to have 30 missions as a wingman before you could take the lead as a shooter. It was after the war, teaching at the U.S. Air Force Weapons School at Nellis Air Force Base in southern Nevada, that he made his mark. In a military that values frequent rotations of personnel, he spent an unprecedented 6 years there as an instructor. Fighter pilots are not a humble lot. By the time they show up at Nellis, they're already considered the best pilots in the Air Force, and they exhibit a certain swagger. Boyd had a foolproof way of dismantling a pilot's ego, so he'd actually learn what Boyd had to teach. He'd invite them up into the air and have the student fly on his six directly behind him, the best position in an aerial dogfight. Then he'd tell the student to engage. Without fail, within 40 seconds, he'd be lining up a kill shot on the student's six, all the while screaming, "Guns, guns, guns," into the radio. This was before the advent of lasers and computers and simulated weapons. It was that yell that told the student he was dead. Boyd's unfailing success earned him a second nickname that would stay with him, 42nd Boyd. His other sobriquet, the Mad Major, was a moniker earned from his, energetic declarations. They were almost always delivered with his face 3 inches from whoever was contradicting him while he poked the opponent's chest with 2 fingers. Unfailingly, in those 2 fingers was a lit Dutch Master cigar. Legend had it that occasionally, quite by accident, I'm sure, he'd light his adversary's tie on fire. At such times, he'd show no contrition, using any weapon in his arsenal to win an argument. Boyd had the ability to see the whole battle space. As he put it in an oral history, "I would see myself in a vast ball. I would be inside the ball, and I could visualize all the actions taking place around the ball, while all the time, of course, I am maneuvering. I could visualize from 2 reference points. When I was fighting air to air, I could see myself as a detached observer looking at myself, plus all the others around me." That kind of awareness, the ability to see a whole sphere of sky and watch events unfold, shaped his military theories and eventually rewrote How America Wages War. When Boyd left the weapons school, he decided to study engineering, and while doing so, he created a model of aircraft performance that described air-to-air combat in terms of energy relationships. Energy maneuverability theory, or EM, takes into account an airplane's kinetic and potential energies in any situation, its altitude, airspeed, and direction, and how fast it can change any of those variables. The theory was eventually baked into the way most fighter aircraft are modeled, directly leading to the development of the F-15 and the F-16 the dominant fighters of the last 40 years. The problem was, according to Boyd's theory, the MiG-15 should have wiped the floor with F-86 Sabre. It just didn't make sense. Boyd, according to Robert Corum's biography, went into frequent trances for days as he tried to figure it out. He was sure his theory was right, but what was the reason for the 10-to-1 kill ratio racked up by American pilots? Training? That could only explain part of it. Tactics? Maybe, but again, that factor wouldn't lead to so lopsided a result. And then it hit him. The American pilots could see better and act faster. Not through any quality inherent in the pilots, but through some simple design choices. The Sabre had a bubble canopy, while the MiG had one with multiple glass panes and struts blocking the pilot's vision. The F-86 also had fully hydraulically powered flight controls, while the MiG had only hydraulically assisted controls. MiG-15 pilots were known to lift weights to give themselves the upper body strength to maneuver the aircraft. As a result, the American pilots could see the MiGs first, and then, crucially, they could act on that information faster than the Chinese and North Korean pilots. The battle was decided not by what the machine could do, but by how fast observation was translated into action. The MiG would take one action, the American pilot would respond, and while the MiG pilot was trying to respond to that, the American pilot could take another action. He'd respond to each new alignment of the MiG so much faster that the more technologically advanced plane became a sitting duck. The same phenomenon occurred in Vietnam when I was there. By then, there were different airplanes squaring off, the MiG-21 and the F-4. But once again, the superior visibility of the F-4 overcame the superior maneuverability of the Soviet-made plane. As Boyd would put it, his most famous innovation put pilots inside the enemy's decision loop. This insight has become fundamental to how wars are fought. And it's exactly what I designed Scrum for, to allow a product owner to make decisions quickly based on real-time feedback. By getting constant input from whoever is getting value from what you're doing, be it the person clicking the buy button on Amazon, the parishioners of your church, the children in a classroom, or someone trying on a dress, you're in a position to constantly adjust your strategy and more quickly succeed. The idea goes by the somewhat ludicrous name of the OODA loop. That's short for observe, orient, decide, and act. And while it may sound funny on the tongue, it's deadly in war and in business. Getting inside someone's loop reduces them to confusion and doubt. They overreact and underreact. As Boyd put it in a briefing he gave to other officers, he who can handle the quickest rate of change survives. Observe is fairly obvious. It's clearly seeing the situation as it unfolds. This isn't as simple as it sounds, though. Boyd described it as moving outside of yourself so as to see the whole picture, not merely your own point of view. Orient is not just about where you are, it's also about what outcomes you're capable of seeing, the menu of alternatives you create for yourself. Factoring into that creation, according to Boyd, are genetic heritage, cultural traditions, previous experiences, and, of course, the unfolding circumstances. Thus, orientation reflects not only how you see the world and your place in it, but what world you're capable of seeing. The combination of observation and orientation leads to a decision, which leads to action. Then the loop begins again with observation of the results of your actions and those of your opponent, or in the business world, observation of the reaction of the marketplace. What Scrum does by delivering a working increment is give the product owner the ability to see how much value that increment creates, how people react to it. Then, based on that information, she can change what the team will do in the next sprint. This sets up a constant feedback cycle that accelerates innovation and adaptation and enables the product owner to measure how much value is delivered. In business, we measure that by money. If I'm painting the interior of a house, I might measure it by rooms completed. The product owner thus has the ability to adjust on the fly to a constantly changing world. It can be difficult to imagine incremental releases on products or projects that don't seem, on the face of it, to have any value until they're complete. For example, how do you do incremental releases of a car or a $100 million video game? The key is to look for what slices actually hold value, enough value that you can get real feedback on them and react in real time. Let's take cars, for example. Toyota developed the Prius from concept to delivery in 15 months, faster than any delivery they'd ever done. While the team that designed and built the Prius didn't start selling their car before it was completed, they did start rapidly prototyping the car so that the chief engineer could kick the tires and see if the team was going in the right direction. This kind of rapid prototyping, making fully functional vehicles before release, and then improving those prototypes over and over until you have the product you want to sell to consumers, can drive incredibly fast changes. The key is not to have a fully established design at the beginning, but rather to make a functional prototype, then see what you can improve. And then, having improved it, to make the next prototype and improve that one. The idea is that the sooner you have some real feedback, the faster you can make a better car. Team Wikispeed, which I spoke about in Chapter 4, produces full prototypes of their car every week, and they sell those prototypes. These transactions don't occur in a mass market. Team Wikispeed isn't ready for that yet. But there are early adopters who are willing to put down $25,000 for those early prototypes. When you're thinking about building something, don't assume you can't deliver something of value until the very end. Instead, try to think about the minimum viable product. What is the absolute least I can build and still deliver some value to a customer? Video games are another good example. Nowadays, more and more developers are letting early adopters pay for early alpha access. That way, the developers get feedback from their most dedicated fans before the game really works. This allows them to see how people actually react rather than guess how they will react. Depending on the industry you're part of, or the organization you run, it can be difficult to wrap your head around this idea of incremental releases. A fallback, if you can't put something before an external customer, is to identify an internal customer. For example, the product owner, who can act in lieu of the public. Show your internal customer whatever will elicit useful feedback, bits and pieces of a real estate expansion plan, a factory upgrade design, a braking system rebuild, a volunteer service campaign, whatever. The idea is to create for yourself an opportunity to inspect and adapt. A company or organization that can't react to changing conditions, competitors, or tastes is in trouble. Boyd puts it this way. We want to get inside another guy's tempo or rhythm where we will pull him down. We got to get an image or picture in our head, which we call orientation. Then we have to make a decision as to what we're going to do and then implement that decision. Then we look at the resulting action, plus our observation, and we drag in new data, new orientation, new decision, new action, ad infinitum. Orientation isn't just a state you're in, it's a process. You're always orienting. A nice tight little world where there's no change? Creatures who live in such a world are dinosaurs. They're going to die. The name of the game is not to become a dinosaur. If you're in an equilibrium condition, you're dead. The underlying message is simple. There is no way out. That's the way it is, guys. That's the way it is, guys. As I said in Chapter 1, there's a pretty stark choice in front of you. Change or die. If you don't get inside your competition's decision loop, they'll get inside yours. As Boyd said, what I want to do is fold my adversary back inside himself. Then I can drive him into confusion and disorder and bring about paralysis. I don't know about you, but me, I'd rather be on the doing end of that than the receiving end. First things first. So, you have a product owner who's constantly updating the backlog, ordering the stuff to be built and delivered. When you have a few hundred items, that ordering process can get pretty complex pretty fast. The key is to figure out how to deliver the most value the most quickly. There may be many millions of ways to arrange that backlog, but the one you want delivers those 20% of features that hold 80% of the value as quickly as possible. Your first guess for the first sprint almost certainly won't be the right one, but it will be your best guess at the time. But that's just your first guess. After the first sprint, once you've completed the OODA loop and delivered some product to customers, you'll change that order, realizing that another arrangement is actually better. And then you keep doing it, continually updating and reprioritizing the backlog each sprint. tacking toward the order that delivers value the fastest. You'll probably never reach the absolute perfect order, but you want to move toward it step by step, sprint by sprint. The key thing to remember is that the order is always in flux. The right order one week won't be the same the next. Your environment will have changed. You'll have learned new things. You'll have discovered that some things are easier and some harder. So this constant shifting of the backlog order happens every single sprint. The key is to acknowledge uncertainty, to fully accept that your current snapshot of order and value is only relevant at that one particular moment. It'll change again and again and again. One bad habit a company can fall into because of constantly shifting market needs and because managers don't know exactly where the most value lies is prioritizing everything. Everything is top priority. The adage to keep in mind comes from Frederick II of Prussia, later to be called the Great. He who will defend everything defends nothing. By not concentrating both your resources and your mental energies, you thin them out to irrelevancy. A few years ago, I celebrated my 70th birthday in Normandy in France. I went to the famous beach where my own father had landed during the D-Day invasion. At low tide, Omaha Beach looks as if it slopes for miles before sinking into the distant sea, a seemingly endless spread of sand. Running up that long, wet slope into the face of the German guns must have required a courage that can only be imagined. Walking through the graves of the thousands who died that day demands silence and respect. But as I started reading about the German defenses, I realized that one of the reasons the American landing was successful was that the Germans forgot Frederick the Great's admonition. So confused were they by Allied deceptions that they spread their forces across the entire coast of France. As a result, the Allies could isolate each German unit separately, defeating each and then moving on to the next. The Nazis didn't prioritize properly, and, thankfully, they lost it all. Release. So you have the priorities, you know where 80% of the value lies. When do you deliver your product? Here is where Scrum can deliver value radically faster. Whenever you're making something, you want to put it in the hands of those who are actually going to use it as fast as possible. You want to do this even before you make 20% of the features. You want to do this with something that delivers at least a tiny bit of value. I call this a minimum viable product, or MVP. This should be the thing you show to the public for the first time. How effective does it have to be? Well, it should actually work, though to the person who has been working on it, it may seem kind of embarrassing. You need to get that product out to the public as early as is feasible. This will get you the feedback you need to power your decision loop and prioritization. This is version 0.5. This is a camera that can take a picture but can't focus. This is a dining room set with two chairs. This is distributing a vaccine to 5 out of the 100 villages you're trying to help. It's almost laughably incomplete. But what it gets you is feedback. The camera's body is really awkward to hold because the shutter button is in a weird place. The chair's wood doesn't match the tables closely enough. You manage to offend the village elders through a totally avoidable social faux pas. Make those mistakes early with as little damage as possible. Then, when you do an official release or roll out of a big program, you'll have already adjusted and found out what people actually value. In our camera example, maybe it turns out that picture takers said that having a landscape mode and being able to share photos on Facebook were equally valuable. But when they actually started using it, they never used the landscape mode, but always wanted to post photos on Facebook. This allows you to make the features they value first and release your product when you've only done about 20% of the work. You know it's not perfect, but it's darn close. Every hour spent polishing the apple is lost opportunity for value. What's great about this process is that it's iterative. Just rinse and repeat. Once people have your product or service or change in their lives, they'll tell you what the next most valuable things are. Then develop 20% of that and deliver again and again. With this incremental release process and the time it would have taken you to create half of the features of your initial product or project, you've now released 200% of the value in half the time. That's the real power of Scrum. That's how it can fundamentally change not only how you work, but how you live your life. Don't focus on delivering a whole list of things, everything and the kitchen sink. Focus on delivering what's valuable, what people actually want or need. I'm reminded of stories out of Iraq or Afghanistan. They went like this. An American platoon comes into town, looks around, and says, "These people are raising chickens. Let's build them a chicken processing plant." So they spend millions of dollars building a state-of-the-art chicken plant. They don't consider that there's almost no regular electricity, or that the townsfolk are mostly illiterate and can't easily be trained on the equipment. Then someone comes to town and asks the villagers, "What would really help you?" And they say, "You know, a footbridge across the river would be great, so we don't have to spend half a day going to the nearest crossing to get to market." That footbridge cost a few hundred dollars. It looks a lot less impressive than a big plant. It doesn't sound dramatic when you talk to your bosses back in Washington, but to those townspeople, it's infinitely more valuable than the fancy building with the now rusting machines. Another point worth making is that sometimes you finish early. Let's say you're making a super next-generation alarm clock for Alarm Clock Inc. You have a list with dozens of features on it. A clock, a snooze button, a timer, a loud alarm, a radio, an iPhone dock, a GPS, whatever. But being a savvy product owner, you prioritize what people really want. An easy-to-set-up alarm, sufficient loudness, a radio, and a display vivid enough to be seen whether the room is bright or dark. And when your team is done with that, you realize that they've actually created the most elegant alarm clock ever made. It's the Apple iPod of alarm clocks. It's beautiful and does one thing really, really well. Instead of having your team build additional features onto it, you release that clock and start work on the next project. The team can deliver more value doing something else. Money for nothing and change for free. At this book's beginning, I told you the story of the Sentinel Project at the FBI. If you remember, an outsourced contractor spent hundreds of millions of dollars building software that didn't work. One of the big sources of the cost overruns there, and in just about any contract, be it to build computer software, airplanes, or buildings, is change fees. Racking up change fees is actually the business model of a bunch of government contractors. They'll underbid a project knowing that they'll make a profit because of change orders. When a contract is written on a years-long project with all the requirements spelled out in those pretty-looking charts, it's tempting to say, "Well, that covers it." Then the contractor says, "I'm agreeing to do this and only this. If you want any changes, it will cost you." This after-the-fact billing has become the center of so much cost that companies and agencies have set up change control boards. From a cost point of view, it makes sense. Limit the number of changes, and you'll limit the cost associated with them. What the bean counters don't realize is that they're setting up a system that is designed to deny people what they actually want. They're trying to limit cost, but in doing so, they're limiting learning, innovation, and creativity. If you begin a project and realizing a little way in that the real value, that 20%, doesn't reside in the features you laid out, it lives in a different set of things you discovered in the process of doing the work, traditional project management is set up to stop you. It's set up to stop delivering value faster. Plus, the effort to exercise firm control doesn't even work. Even with change control boards trying to limit changes, the need for change is so great that they're often overruled. Without the changes, there wouldn't be any value in the project. So grudgingly, the change control boards allow it, and the project costs more. And then there's another change that has to be done. And whoops, there's another. And pretty soon, the project is millions of dollars over budget, and a year, or 2, or 5 years late. That's why I came up with the idea of change for free. In a standard fixed-price contract, just say, "Changes are free." List all the functionality you expect. For example, if you're building a tank, you want one that can go 75 miles per hour and shoot 10 rounds a minute, has seating for 4, has AC, and so on and so on. Everything you think you need for that tank. The builder looks at that description and says, making that engine, I'll call that 100 points. The loading mechanism, let's call that 50, the seating, 5, and so on down the list. At the end, there's a set number of points for each feature. Then every sprint, the customer, who in this scenario is contractually obligated to work closely with the product owner, can change priorities completely. Any item or feature in the backlog can be moved anywhere else. And new features, no problem. Just drop equivalently sized features from the deliverables. Oh, you want a laser-guided system now? Well, that's 50 points of work. To compensate for that addition, let's drop 50 points of low-priority features from the bottom of the backlog. A few companies have taken to a new level this idea of only delivering to a customer high-value features. A few years ago, I heard about a Scrum developer that got a $10 million contract to deliver software for a big construction company. The two parties agreed on a 20-month time frame. But the Scrum company inserted a clause into the contract. If the construction firm wanted to terminate at any time, they could. They just have to pay 20% of the value of the remaining contract. Basically, if the software worked the way the construction firm wanted, they could stop the Scrum shop from building any more. The software developer started sprinting. They did one-month sprints. After the first month, the customer redirected some of that developer's effort to get more value. In the second month, the same thing. After the third month, the customer terminated the contract, took the software, and put it to work. They had the value they needed. Let's do a little math here to see how everyone won. In the first 3 months of the contract, the customer paid out $1.5 million to the Scrum firm. Terminating the contract early required them to pay 20% of the remaining $8.5 million. That's $1.7 million. They paid out $3.2 million for a piece of software they thought would cost $10 million, and they got it 17 months early. And they weren't the only winner. The Scrum company bid on the contract with an expected profit margin of 15%. So they spent $1.3 million on development in those first 3 months, but they received $3.2 million. Their profit margin went from 15% to over 60%. That's a 400% increase in earnings. And now, with their developers idle, they could bid on other projects. That's not just good business. That's an early retirement strategy. They could do this because of the building blocks of Scrum. By managing themselves as a cross-functional unit, the team was able to accelerate quickly, delivering more value faster. At the end of every sprint, an increment of the product was done. It worked. It could be deployed immediately. Each sprint, the product owner was able to reprioritize the backlog based on customer feedback. And when there was enough value created for the customer, everyone stopped working. In this way, Scrum aligns everyone's interests, those of the team, the Scrum Master, the product owner, the customer, and the company. Everyone works toward the same goal and with the same vision: deliver real value as fast as possible. I'm a big believer in win-win situations, and making more money, delivering better products at a lower price, strikes me as a pretty good deal. Risk. Management of risk is at the heart of any successful venture. What Scrum allows you to do is reduce the risks of failure. The three most common types are market risk, technical risk, and financial risk. Or to put it another way, do people want what we're building? Can we actually build it? Can we really sell what we've built? I've written a lot about market risk. Scrum helps you minimize it by emphasizing incremental delivery. It allows you to put a product in front of customers faster. And by obtaining feedback early and often, you can make small changes on the spot rather than be forced into big changes after you've invested millions of dollars and realize that what you're building isn't really what the customer actually wants. It's often what the customer said they wanted at the beginning of the process, but in reality, people don't know what they really want until they can try something out. A lot of business advice revolves around failing quickly. I prefer to think about delivering fast. Technical risk is interesting. The question of whether it's actually possible to build what the customer wants is a tricky one, especially if you're making something that is physical, which requires plants and tooling and upfront investment. Remember the company with the home automation system? Well, they approached it by doing what is called set-based concurrent engineering. What that means in English is building a few different prototypes to see which one works best before going into full production. For example, they knew that they needed a camera so customers could see who was knocking at their door and buzz the visitor in. The most expensive part of the camera, and the one that required the most lead time, was the lens. Should it be plastic? Glass? Crystal? What holds up in any weather? What scratches easily? What gives the clearest picture? How much does each type cost to manufacture? Instead of making the decision up front and going full bore into manufacturing, they built three different fully functional lenses and compared them. Since they were only really trying to figure out the lens question, and they had to do it first because of long lead times in manufacturing, they tested each lens using a laptop camera setup. Turned out, glass met the criteria the best. But critically, they were able to make that judgment after seeing something that actually worked. The call wasn't based on theoretical constructs. They had something they could look at and touch. With that question answered, they could move on to designing the case that would hold the lens and the processors that would handle the image. By prioritizing that lens decision, the company potentially saved themselves millions. Apple famously does this with all their products, often building a dozen fully functioning prototypes before organizing a shootout to see which one is the best. This allows different ideas to be expressed quickly without a massive investment. Financial risk is what causes most companies to fail. They've built something cool, but they can't sell it for enough to actually make a profit. A classic example of this is online journalism and the death of the newspaper. When the web first exploded in the 90s, newspapers were eager to get their content on the internet. Some newspaper chiefs figured that, offline or on, people would pay to advertise, so they made the content free. The problem, of course, was that advertisers were willing to pay far less money for online ads than print ads. Yet the cost of producing content remained the same. Others tried to put up paywalls in front of their content, but there were so many sites offering news for free that they were often forced to follow suit. Having actual reporters go places and witness things is expensive. You can see the results in the shuttering of newsrooms across the country. This idea of providing content or a service for free and then making money on the advertising is still prevalent in tech startups to this day. Entrepreneurs look at Facebook or Google and say, "I can do that." The problem is that there just aren't that many Facebooks and Googles. In the internet's early days, when online space first allowed companies to target particular customer segments, hyper-focusing was seen as valuable. But as more and more platforms have arisen to facilitate it, the capability doesn't quite have the same allure. Another way that companies fall apart financially is by overpaying to acquire customers. One example is daily coupon companies such as Groupon and Living Social. At their inception, they acquired customers quickly and easily. But as they expanded their reach and built up their headcount, it became more and more costly to attract additional advertisers and more people willing to buy a coupon. You can see the results in these companies' valuations. What Scrump does for business is answer the key question fast. Will we make money making this? By putting incremental releases in front of customers quickly, you'll find out what your customers value and what they're willing to pay for. And if your first guesses were wrong, you can make changes. The most you can lose is the cost in time and energy of the few sprints you invested, as opposed to the multi-million dollar cost of building a huge, complicated infrastructure, only to find out that while people loved your product, they didn't love it enough to pay what it cost to make it. Here's what you do tomorrow. Okay, what do you do tomorrow to implement Scrum where you work? The first step is just putting together a backlog and a team. Think about the vision you have for your product or service or whatever, and start breaking down the things you need to do to execute that vision. You don't need a whole lot, just a week's worth of backlog. And while the team members are holding their daily stand-up meetings and running their first sprint, you'll be able to build up enough backlog to keep the team busy for the next two sprints. Always keep one eye on that backlog, though, because as your team accelerates, they'll start delivering more than you thought possible. Then, as the product owner, put together a roadmap of where you think things are going. What do you think you can get done this quarter? Where do you want to be this year? It's important to remember that this is just a snapshot in time, so don't overplan. Just estimate. You're not creating a binding contract of deliverables. You're simply setting down your thoughts on where you'll be in a while. Believe me, the picture will change, perhaps radically. The reason for doing this type of planning is to create transparency within the organization. If you have a sales team, they need to know what features you're working on so they can start marketing them. Leadership needs to have some idea of where the revenue is going to come from, also when and how much. The key message is that everything is being done in the open. Anyone can see where your product is at any time. They can see the stories move across the Scrum board to done. They can graph story points against time on a burn down chart and watch a nice steady line move toward zero or burn down. They know how many story points your team did last sprint and how many you're estimating they'll do next. Know that as the product owner, you're going to be evaluated on revenue and cost. What you'll quickly find, especially if you're working in a place with multiple teams, is that you'll need to start putting together a product owner team so you can generate enough backlog for the teams to plow through. You might have one product owner who focuses more on strategy and customer interaction, and another who's more tactical, deciding what the teams will be working on during each sprint. The important thing, though, is just to begin. Just start. You'll hear the detailed steps on how to do it in the appendix. Scrum is designed so that you can boot up a team in a couple of days. Get your backlog, plan your first sprint, and away you go. You don't need to devote a lot of time to planning, reflection, meditations, mission statements, or 5-year projections. Leave all that to the competition and let them eat your dust. And along the way, why don't you make the world a better place? In the next chapter, I'll tell you how. The takeaway. Make a list, check it twice. Create a list of everything that could possibly be done on a project, then prioritize it. Put the items with the highest value and lowest risk at the top of that backlog, then the next, and then the next. The product owner. She translates vision into backlog. She needs to understand the business case, the market, and the customer. A leader isn't a boss. A product owner sets out what needs to be done and why. How the team accomplishes it and who accomplishes it is up to the team. The product owner has knowledge of the domain and the power to make final decisions. He or she is available to answer questions and is accountable for delivering value. Observe, orient, decide, act. OODA. See the whole strategic picture, but act tactically and quickly. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. It's better to give than to receive. Get inside your competition's OODA loop and wrap them up in their own confusion. Get your money for nothing and your change for free. Create new things only as long as those new things deliver value. Be willing to swap them out for things that require equal effort. What in the beginning you thought you needed is never what is actually needed. Chapter 9. Change the world. Scrum has its origins in the world of software development. Now, it's sweeping through myriad other places where work gets done. Diverse businesses are using it for everything from building rocket ships to managing payroll to expanding human resources. And it's also popping up in everything from finance to investment, from entertainment to journalism. I'm often amazed that a process I pioneered in 1993 to aid software development has proven itself universally applicable. Scrum accelerates human effort. It doesn't matter what that effort is. In fact, I've begun to see it spring up in the most unlikely places, addressing the thorniest of humanity's problems. Think about some of those problems. For example, people living in poverty, which is not only demeaning, but spawns a host of social ills, from crime and corruption to war and destruction. Then there's our system of education, which is failing students the world over. Instead of teaching 21st century skills, we've mired our young people in ways of teaching and learning created in the 19th century. And the other out-of-whack element that comes to mind is government, which has seized up in many ways, predicating itself on ideas formed hundreds of years ago that no longer seem to fit with the way we live our lives. It's easy to throw up your hands at the latest news of people dying in Africa, violence in our schools, or the endless posturing of people in power. It just seems like too much at times. But those problems, the hard problems, are precisely what Scrum is designed to address. In each of those cases, people are now turning to Scrum to help solve those problems. And, just as in the business world, they're showing remarkable success. Education. In some ways, bedroom communities are the same the world over. Lying a few miles outside a major metropolis, they're where people move to buy a cheaper house, raise a family, and send their kids to school without many of the problems of the big city. Alphen aan den Rijn is a pretty typical town in that sense. It lies in the west of the Netherlands between Leiden and Utrecht, maybe 45 minutes from Amsterdam. As you approach the town by road on a school day, all the traffic is headed in the other direction to jobs elsewhere. Dairy farms and windmills, old and new, cover the countryside. Inside the town, the traffic is almost all bicycles. Hundreds and hundreds are headed to the local public secondary school, Ashram College. The school, like the town, is fairly typical for a Dutch school. There are about 1,800 students, ranging in age from 12 to 18. Holland tracks its students early, splitting the children among lower vocational programs, aimed at producing everything from hairdressers to mechanics to secretaries, higher vocational programs, aimed at gearing kids towards nursing, management, and engineering, and university-bound programs, aimed at those heading for medicine, the law, or research. The kids on the lower tracks can enter the workforce at 16, while those in the higher track might spend much of their 20s in university and professional education. Each of the different tracks requires some core classes in common, though each group is taught those subjects separately. Ashram teaches all three tracks, and one of those core subjects is what Willy Wynans teaches to students at every grade level in the school, chemistry. I'm sure you have memories of high school chemistry, lab tables in straight rows facing the teacher at the front of the room, perhaps a week of lecture followed by a few days working on a practical problem with a lab partner, the choice of whom was often strategic and much stressed over. Maybe you liked chemistry, maybe it bored you to tears, and maybe Breaking Bad gave you a new appreciation for the potential monetary reward of good lab technique and the importance of picking the right partner. Whatever your experience, once the teacher began talking about covalent bonds or some other abstruse concept, there was likely a near-audible click as you and your fellow students gazed out the window, doodled pictures, or thought about the cute boy or girl in the second row. Let's face it, in the American classroom, where chemistry leads, daydreaming often follows. That's not what happens in Wynans classes, though. "See," he says, as the students burst into the room and hurry to their desks, oddly without sitting down. "I don't do anything." It's 8:30 a.m. on a normal Wednesday in September, and Wynans' classroom does not look like one. None of the desks are in rows facing the front of the room. Instead, they're positioned so groups of four students can face one another. Instead of sitting down at the beginning of class, these students pull out a large piece of paper covered with sticky notes, put it on the wall, and gather round. The paper is divided into a few large columns. Alle items on the far left, then to doen, then in wittering, and finally klar. As you might guess, they mean all items, to do, in progress, and done. At the bottom of the columns are four additional headings: DOD, or definition of done; grafiek, which points to the burndown chart showing progress toward their goal; and lastly, retrospective and velocity, where they measure how many points they accomplished during each lesson. Their sprints are usually 4 or 5 weeks long, ending with a test. In front of their scrum boards, or flops, as they call them in Dutch, a derivation of the word for flip chart, the students plot what lessons are going to finish today. They move the sticky notes they think they can accomplish from the backlog, alle items, to te doen, and get to work. Again, as Wynans likes to say, he does nothing. The students open their books and start to teach themselves. Perhaps more important, they teach one another. Wynans walks the room, looking at the scrum boards and burndown charts. Occasionally, he'll spot a place where the students are having a problem, or he'll quickly explain a tricky concept, or he'll randomly take a story from the klar column and quiz each student on it, making sure all understand the concepts. If they don't, he moves it back to te doen. Part of the definition of done, you see, is that everyone understands the material. The students do have one part of the scrum board that is unique to them: a definition of fun. Not only does the work have to be complete, they also need to enjoy doing it. The three tests are trust, humor, and a uniquely Dutch word, gezelligheid. There's no good English translation for it. It's described as coziness, or companionability, or fun, or pleasant, or seeing a friend after a long absence, or spending time with loved ones, or simply belonging. Actually, that strikes me as a perfect way to describe the feeling of support, enjoyment, hope, joy, comfort, and excitement of being on a really good team. "You don't have to be the police," says Wynans. "We now have another way to deal with managing students. They do everything. They even assign themselves homework. Each team knows where they are in the material, the dates by which they have to accomplish interim steps, and if they'll need to do work outside of class to learn all the material in time. They are self-organizing. They develop smarter and faster ways to study. One team started with a test and worked backward. A bunch of 11-year-olds.
Not good, I told them. Their faces fell.
Winans grins his contagious smile.
Then I said, excellent.
Scrum, or EduScrum, as Winans calls his approach, is introduced to the students on the first day of class. The first thing they do is choose teams, cross-functional teams. Students rate themselves in various categories, everything from bravery to math enjoyment to taking account of others' feelings to heading straight for the goal. Then the students are told to form teams that are cross-functional, that have all the skills needed to learn the material. This, says Winans, teaches them something just as important as the chemistry. It teaches them to work with and appreciate people with different talents than their own. Tim Jansen is 17 years old. It's his senior year. He's now been doing Scrum for 3 years and is about to head to university, where he plans to study chemistry. He looks like your typical geek. I am someone who can learn faster than others, he says. But working together, you improve, you get better. I learn the material better by explaining it to others. He turns to Gudith Svartz, who is sitting across the table from him. She knows she can ask about content. I can ask her about organization. She can put it together better than I can. Gudith looks quite different from Tim. Slender, pretty, blonde. You get to know more about your classmates. You know who is good at which thing. Scrum helps the outsiders connect with the other parts of the class, chimes in her equally pretty and stylish friend, Monica Bowens. Sometimes you choose the team, and sometimes you get chosen. You learn they are better than you at some qualities. That kind of learning, says Winans, is part of the idea, to make unconscious skills conscious ones. Skills that can be tested on an exam are far from the only important ones. Helping students learn to identify and value different strengths in themselves and others is a 21st century skill. That's something everyone needs to learn. After they pick teams, the students are taught how to estimate, not in hours or days, but in points. They then estimate each piece of the material they need to learn using the relative sizing inherent in the Fibonacci sequence by playing planning poker. Willie explains the idea of points quite simply. Ignore all the measures you were told. There are no absolute measures. If I weigh 50 points, he says, pointing at a slender high school girl, how many points do you weigh? 40, she guesses. Why, thank you. I'd guess more around 20, though. At the end of each set of lessons, the teams do a retrospective, asking themselves, what went right? What could have gone better? And how can the team improve? This focus on teams, says Winans, is sometimes surprising to parents. He tells the story of one mother who called up and said that her daughter had done all the work. Why was she being forced to carry everyone else? I said the girl had to have the courage to tell others to do more. She did, and test scores went up. The mother called back to thank me. The students need to learn not only to work for themselves, but to work together. The energy in the classrooms at Ashram is remarkable, and it translates into results. In the Dutch school system, evaluative grades run from 1 to 10, and 5.5 is considered an acceptable passing grade. In Willie's classes, a 7 is acceptable, and the students meet that baseline. Over the past year, says Winans, test scores have jumped more than 10%. Willie learned about Scrum from his son-in-law, who works at a large technical company in the Netherlands that uses it. Willie's been a teacher for nearly 4 decades, and he says this is what he's been searching for the whole time. An approach that teaches children to teach themselves and to value their own skills and those of others. Also, to have fun while doing so. An important thing to say about Scrum is that it rarely remains a one-off for long. It's built to scale. In the Netherlands schools, for example, EduScrum is not dependent on one person, even as great a teacher as Winans. While it may have started with Willie, and he may have convinced a few of his fellow chemistry teachers at Ashram to give it a try, it's now growing. Supported by the business community, there's now an EduScrum Foundation in the Netherlands that trains teachers and educates schools about Scrum. They've trained 74 teachers so far, in all subjects in 12 schools. They plan on growing by 60 teachers and 15 schools a year. In 5 years,
That will mean 300 more teachers and 75 more schools. A good start. I met with a few of the teachers from across the country, and they told me that this is the new Montessori. They see this as a movement. It's not just happening in the Netherlands, though. In Arizona, there's a charter school for poor, rural, Native American students that uses Scrum. In a few universities, they're starting to teach it. At the Harvard Business School, they've built a new classroom called the Innovation Lab, where all the instruction is based around teams. And as Professor Hirotaka Takeuchi of Harvard told me, when you teach teams, the way you do it is Scrum. While I was at Ashram, I spoke with some of the students there. When I asked what questions they had, one boy raised his hand. "I can't believe you designed this for computer software," he said. "It seems perfectly designed for high school." I felt tears in my eyes as I looked at this young man. I learned later he was autistic. Before Scrum, he'd been unengaged and resigned. Scrum had given him a way to move forward, to actually enjoy school, and to become a better, more complete person. Years ago, when I was trying to fix a few software companies, I hadn't realized that I was also creating something that could help fix people's lives. But it has, and perhaps nowhere more powerfully than in rural Uganda. Poverty. Uganda is one of the poorest countries in the world. More than a third of the people there live on less than $1.25 a day. The vast majority of Ugandans reside in rural areas where poverty is endemic and people struggle to subsist by farming small family plots. Many of these places are beyond remote, days by foot from the nearest market town. Families have a hard time sending children to school since their hands are needed to help on the farm. Girls especially drop out early. Life expectancy is 53 years. Infant mortality is more than 5% of live births, and about 6,000 women die each year from complications in pregnancy. The life of a rural farmer in Uganda is not an easy one. The Grameen Foundation grew out of the Nobel Prize winner Muhammad Yunus's Grameen Bank, which pioneered microfinance for the extremely poor in Bangladesh. The foundation focuses on helping lift the world's poor out of poverty, not by handouts, but by harnessing the underappreciated strengths of the impoverished. In Uganda, they decided to try to do just that, by giving the poor the ability to share and build knowledge. To do it, they recruited some 1,200 people in poor rural areas, people they called Community Knowledge Workers, or CKWs. The foundation had already developed mobile applications for microfinance and payments, and they decided to give these knowledge workers not just banking information, but information they could use in their daily lives, which, in Uganda's case, meant it would be applied to farming. The foundation provided access to the best agricultural practices by giving the workers smartphones and conveying the information that way. Steve Bell of the Lean Enterprise Institute and a certified Scrum Master recently visited two remote villages and described how it works. There's a meeting of farmers standing up in a field. One farmer brought in a plant suffering from a disease. The CKW quickly looked through pictures on the phone until she found a photo of a plant suffering from that particular disease. Then, instantly available was the scientific treatment for the disease, a treatment that didn't require expensive pesticides or chemicals, one that the farmer could immediately act on. Bell says that fast transmission of actionable information would be powerful enough. But the app also links the farmers to others throughout Uganda. Using this connectivity, they can share precisely how much crops are selling for in the nearest market town, often days away. The farmers used to be at the mercy of middlemen who take advantage of the farmers' lack of market knowledge to set prices at whatever level they liked. Now, farmers know how much the middlemen are making. Bell told me the story of one woman who told him that the agricultural data alone doubled her yield. But the market data also doubled her prices. She used to get 300 shillings a bushel, but after she learned they were being sold for 1,000 shillings a bushel, she was able to negotiate a price of 600 shillings. Double the yield, double the profit, the same amount of work. That's what Scrum is designed to do, and that's how it delivered for her. Eric Kamara heads the technology group for the Kinshasa office of the Grameen Foundation. His group uses Scrum to develop their applications. He says that each time a group asks for a feature set, his team rates it on a scale of 1 to 7 on 3 questions. 1. How important is this work to the mission of helping the poor? 2. How will this feature contribute to the work of the CKWs? 3. Is there partner support for the feature? The foundation prefers to work with partners such as the Gates Foundation rather than alone.